Penguin Random House Audio presents The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice by Scott Ellsworth. Read for you by Adenrale Ojo. For Craig Ryan and Kathy Naramore, Amici Veri. A note from the author. The survivors called it the riot. Sitting at their own kitchen tables or in front of a television news camera crew, this was the term that they used to describe the horrific events that they endured in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on May 31st and June 1st, 1921. Sometimes they would say, race riot, but most of the time, the one-word version would do. It was pride that fought the riot. It was pride that rebuilt after the riot, was how survivor W.D. Williams put it. Over the years, however, other names have surfaced as well. Some refer to the tragic happenings as a race war. Others called it a disaster, the Tulsa event, or a pogrom. In an interview with a journalist some 20 years ago, I once likened it to an American Kristallnacht. That wasn't a stretch. Today, the term of choice is massacre, as in the Tulsa Race Massacre. All of these terms capture something of what took place, but in truth, none of them can describe it completely. For what happened in one American city during the late spring of 1921 defies easy definition. Prologue. The Canes, Friday, July 19th, 2019. Noe saw her first. We had just dropped down to the lower level with the railroad tracks behind us and the river in front. Pushing our way past the hickory and ash trees and through the knee-high weeds, we had followed the dirt trail down the embankment to a flat ribbon of earth, maybe 100 yards long and 15 yards wide. Sheltered by the high branches of the cottonwoods, the narrow shelf of land had a peaceful, almost cathedral-like feel. Tufts of soft grass carpeted the forest floor, while sparrows and chickadees flitted by overhead. Had it not been for the trash and the overbearing smell of the open-air privy, it might not have seemed like a homeless camp at all. She had heard us coming. Rising up quickly, she was wearing a white shirt and pink shorts, with newish-looking running shoes and quarter socks. Her reddish-brown hair in a pixie had been recently cut, while her complexion was clear and her fingernails were clean. She was maybe in her early 20s. But out on the street, someone's age can be tough to gauge with any degree of accuracy. Later on, I asked Noe, who was an outreach worker with the Mental Health Association of Oklahoma, to create a mini biography of her, one based both on his experience and what he'd just observed. He thought carefully before he answered. She hasn't been out long, but she's likely been homeless before, he said. Probably not addicted to any drugs, maybe some mental health issues. Her name was Angel. As we drew near, she lifted the bottom hem of her shirt to show us the handle of the knife stuck into the waistband of her shorts. Above us, you could hear the wind in the treetops. Angel's campsite consisted of a piece of blue plastic tarp wrapped in a semicircle around a couple of bushes. Within the perimeter was a relatively new bicycle lying on its side, a Coleman lantern, a pair of rolled-up sleeping bags, and a small pile of clothes and personal items. Nearby, scattered throughout the woods and brush, were other tents, some big enough to stand up in, others sun-bleached cast-offs from camping trips taken decades earlier. Most looked either abandoned or unoccupied, but it was hard to know for certain. From her half-circle home, Angel could look out across the slow-moving waters of the Arkansas River toward the oil refineries on the other side. Sometimes fish would rise in the shallows nearest the bank. Other times, wrens and swallows would arc across the river and then disappear into the trees. High above us, maybe 50 yards downstream, the mid-morning traffic rumbled along the I-244 bridge, oblivious to the trio of people and the homeless camp on the forgotten patch of riverbank below. We were less than a mile from the heart of downtown Tulsa. Population 400,000, with a metropolitan area of nearly 1 million. In a city that was proud of its beautiful homes and churches, its Art Deco architecture, and its world-class museums and vibrant music scene. Indeed, that very week, Cardi B and Shawn Mendes would each perform in front of thousands of screaming fans at the BOK Center, a glittery $196 million arena located less than 8 blocks away. "You want some packets?" Noe asked her. Reaching into the day pack slung over his shoulder, he grabbed a handful of quart-sized plastic zip bags. Most of them contained a toothbrush, toothpaste, and travel-sized containers of lotion and hand sanitizer. Others held bars of soap, breath mints, many deodorants. But each and every packet included a pair of socks. "That's the first thing to go when you're out on the street," Noe had told me back at the outreach center. Angel wouldn't respond at first. Instead, she kept looking behind us, her gray-green eyes darting toward the path through the trees that we had come in on. She mumbled something about her partner getting back any minute now. It was obvious that the sudden appearance of two strange men in the nearly deserted homeless camp had made her very nervous. She wouldn't look either of us in the eye. But Noe kept on talking. He told her about some of the services available to the homeless, about how they could help her find housing and medical care, and he asked if she needed anything. Eventually, Angel relaxed. She took some packets and some bottles of water, and once she had concluded that I wasn't a police officer, she turned toward me. "Just what are you doing here anyway?" "Well," I said, "I'm a historian, and—" I kept on talking, but to myself I thought, really, where to begin? Tulsa Police Headquarters, Winter 1973, around 4 a.m. Inside the break room on the ground floor, a handful of officers unwind after the end of their shifts. Most are recent police academy graduates, young officers who pay their dues by working the fourth shift, which lasts from 7 at night until 3 in the morning. Some have partners, but most work alone. One man to a police cruiser, usually either a Plymouth Fury or an AMC Ambassador, monstrous 1970s machines with V8 engines capable of topping 130 miles per hour. Two-way radios mounted on the dash have two frequencies, one for communication with the dispatcher, the other, the backside, where officers can talk. But most of the night, you are on your own. It is lonesome work, occasionally dangerous, sometimes stressful, and often boring. Beneath the dash in a custom-built rack is a loaded 12-gauge pump shotgun. The break room, which the officers call the lounge, is a Spartan affair. Linoleum floors over concrete slab, cinder block walls painted a shade of municipal beige, fluorescent lights, formica tables, padded vinyl chairs, but not very padded, a former officer told me. There is also a wall of vending machines humming quietly in the background, which sell pop, candy bars, bags of potato chips, and 4-ounce paper cups of instant coffee. Awful stuff, the officer added. On this night, some of the men are smoking cigarettes, others are talking quietly, when Sergeant Wayburn J. Cotton enters the room, carrying a cardboard box. If you can keep your mouth...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?